Thank you all for joining. I know it is late in the evening. It's been a long day full of awesome talks. So really appreciate you coming here, even though energy is starting to flag a bit. I hope I can re-energize you with the topic of privacy at the code level. And thank you, of course, to the org team and all the angels who made it possible for us to be here during the Linux Tiger. To briefly introduce myself and my perspective on privacy, I'm Kat. My background is a mix of privacy, security, and software engineering. And for the last few years, I've been building up Dynatrace's privacy engineering team. Dynatrace is a SaaS provider. We offer an AI-powered observability platform, and lots of our customers are large enterprise customers in highly regulated sectors like finance, healthcare, telecommunications, and government. So my day-to-day perspective on privacy, I'm thinking about how can we protect all of this very confidential data that we're processing on behalf of our customers. And also, in addition to that, in addition to our internal privacy controls protecting the data we're processing, thinking about how to build privacy features actually into the product, because our customers know best what they're processing, and they know best how to configure the product so that they can use their observability features in a responsible way. And this tension between observability and privacy I find really fascinating. Love working on it and trying to navigate that tension. Now, when I was preparing this talk, I had a look at which perspectives we'd previously explored on privacy, because I know this is a topic that is really, really important to us as a community. And at the Grazia Linux Tiger, we've been hearing about GDPR since the very early days. Elsewhere, at other conferences, we've covered everything from privacy in automated vacuum cleaners all the way through to mass surveillance and evading authorship detection in cases where that makes sense. So really, a huge range of perspectives. I will definitely not be able to cover all of these today. So if this topic of privacy intrigues you, I'd really encourage you to check out the other content that we've got available on the CCC Media site. In particular, I'd like to call out these two talks. Danny's talk on personal privacy threat modeling, protecting yourself against stalkers and against government intrusion into your private life, and Jaap Henk's talk on privacy design strategies. His talk is at a slightly higher abstraction level than what I want to talk about today. I want to dig into the code level details. And Jaap Henk presents some really good ways to think about the higher level privacy design decisions that you might make when you're starting off in a software project. Before we continue, I can hear a bit of feedback with my mic. Is this bothering anyone? Should we change the setup? I can hear myself breathing, but if you can't, that's fine. I will take that as it's okay. Yeah? All right. So yes, today we're not looking at the legal side. We're not looking at personal privacy. There is lots of content about all these other fascinating topics. I want to explore how we as open source developers can protect our users' privacy. But first, what even is privacy? Are we actually using the same definition here? Are we all on the same page? Now, this is definitely an oversimplification, but I think it's a useful one. When we think about the differences between security and privacy, in security, we're typically thinking about how to secure the data or a system, the infrastructure that the system runs on, maybe even the people who maintain the system. And that's really, really crucial. And it's an essential prerequisite for the slightly different questions that privacy asks. We look at many of the same aspects of the system, but instead we're asking, is the data being used appropriately within this secure system? So a core difference here is that our threat actor actually might be the system or our business model. That's never popular when you bring it up in a corporate context, but that can be the case with privacy to an extent that's there's no real security equivalent there. And when I say we need to use data appropriately, what do we mean by that? What I mean is that we need context-appropriate flows of data. We can't lock down personal data. Society would stop running overnight if we stopped sharing all personal data completely. But it needs to be appropriate to the context we're in. Formally, this is known as the theory of contextual integrity that was developed by the researcher Helen Nissenbaum. But I think informally, it's easy to understand if we just take a look at a few different scenarios. Imagine, for example, that I'm in the back of an ambulance. I've had a really bad accident. And I'm being asked questions about my health. Do you have any allergies? Are you taking regular medication that you might need while you're in hospital? And In that context, I will be very happy to answer those questions because I want to get the best possible care in hospital. And it makes sense to ask me those questions at that time. If we take those same questions in a different scenario, different context, maybe I'm in a job interview and you're asking me about my health, and now I am thoroughly creeped out. And probably if you continue, I'm going to walk out of that interview and never talk to the company again. Because it's creepy. And this creepiness is a really good informal way of thinking about privacy. You don't need lots of domain knowledge, you don't need legal knowledge, you can start with the question, would I find this use of my data creepy? And then start to expand that to your users, because your users might have a different opinion on that than you do. They might come from a very different culture than yours. They might be using your software in a context you never expected. They found an unusual use case for it. So they might care about different things and be afraid of different things than you are when you answer that question, is this creepy? Very important to keep in mind is how technically literate are your users, because as developers, we are often very, very technically literate and we really overestimate the technical literacy of our users. Some research studies, for example, have found that more than 50% of the participants didn't understand the concept of a default browser on their phone. So imagine, how can you meaningfully make a choice about which privacy-preserving default browser you're going to use if you don't know what a default browser is? What does that even mean? So to help users here, we might need to guide them in the UI with icons, with simple language, really taking them through these concepts that we take for granted because we work with them every day. If you've ever spoken to a privacy person and they kept telling you, like, it depends, I can't give you any fixed rules, it really depends, it's all because privacy is contextual and depends on the context we're operating in. I know that's frustrating. It frustrates me when I'm the person saying, it depends, I can't give you any fixed rules. What I can give you are some guiding principles that we can think about as we go through the examples today. First and foremost, we want to minimize the data we collect. And I've deliberately just said data there, not just personal data, because what you might not consider personal or sensitive might be very sensitive for some of your users. So minimize the data overall that you're collecting. Make sure for each data type, you really have a good reason why you're collecting it, and your users understand why too. And if you find some cool new use case, some way you can repurpose the data you've collected, make sure you ask them for consent, and again, make sure they understand what you're actually going to do with their data. And we need to watch out for unexpected data transfers, and we'll look at some unexpected ways this can happen. I will also be talking you through how we can threat model the potential harms that might come to our users from these data transfers, because some data transfers might be quite innocent, and we don't need to worry, and others could potentially lead to harm for our users if we don't really consider what safeguards we can put in place. So let's dive into those examples. In case you weren't already tired of everything having generative AI in it, our motivating example today will be a chat app. And if this shameless ripoff of commercial apps offends you, imagine we're working on a much more fully featured project like LibreChat. What mistakes might we make as we develop this chat app? Let's start at the data model level. When I open the chat app in its dedicated app or in the browser, it greets me by my first name. And to get that, it makes a request to our users API, which returns this enormous blob of data. Let's walk through what we've got. We've got a user ID. OK, that seems reasonable. My full email address, my full name, a link to the profile picture that's in a public S3 bucket, the timestamp which I created my account, and even my phone number, or at least some dummy data that's standing in for my phone number. If I go back to the UI, this is totally unnecessary. All we need is my first name. And I think some of you will be able to easily imagine why this happened. We are just storing all of our user data in one place. Maybe we have one users table in the database, or we store each user as one JSON blob. And we're very lazily returning absolutely everything we've got each time we need some kind of user data. This clearly doesn't respect our guiding principle of data minimization. So what we could do is split this up into separate data transfer objects based on our use cases. This is just one example, and it would really the best possible approach would really depend on the specific implementation of our chat app and when we're using user data. One option might be we have a very simple user DTO that just has the ID and the name. We could use that on the home page. We might also want to split the name up into first name and last name, so we're not splitting that at runtime, because that could go wrong. then that picture can move to a user profile object that we use whenever we're working with profiles, maybe has extra fields like an about me description that I can edit. And then we can have a billing object, a contact object for all our other use cases. The phone number would fit much better there, for example. And now when we query user data, we're just getting exactly what we need. Nothing more, nothing less. And ideally, this would go all the way down to the database schema. So we fixed our users API, we think. We're now using a more appropriate data model. But unfortunately, if you see here, our users API queries users by email address. And this is surprisingly common, even if you don't care about privacy, it's an anti-pattern. One reason that's not privacy related, you might not want to do this, if this goes all the way down to the database level and we use the email address as our primary key for users, then we are going to be very, very unhappy the first time a user says, hey, could I update my email address and keep the same account? Because that is going to be a very, very unpleasant manual operation in prod. So even from a non-privacy perspective, we don't want to be doing this. From the privacy perspective, this means that we are sending personal data in the URL, and that's going to get stored in several different places along the network path. In this specific case, if you look at the response headers, we're using Netlify's serverless functions. So even though this looks like it's a request to catchat.at, actually the DNS record points to Netlify, and the data is being transferred to the US. Now, that isn't necessarily a problem. There's lots of appropriate context to use serverless functions in, but we should really be keeping in mind what data we're sending to Netlify here. And from the SaaS provider perspective, I can tell you with certainty, Netlify do not want you to be sending them personal data in the URL paths. That's a nightmare for them and for their use of observability. They don't want to have to protect this data, so don't send it to them. Instead, we could just simply query users by ID. Problem solved. We might also want to check the request headers for any other sensitive data, as that often gets logged along the network path. So we fixed our users API. And now we want to better understand which devices users are using our app and our web app from, so that we can offer the best possible support for them. Are they on mobile or on desktop? And given the audience here, I imagine this is a worst-case scenario that none of you would actually do. But suspend disbelief for a moment, we've decided to use Google Analytics. And so now we have these collect requests being made as users browse or use our chat app. And there's lots of cryptically named payload items that are being sent each time. We've got some really detailed information about the user's device. We do have a unique client ID that's assigned to this device. But even if we didn't have that, these individual details are usually uniquely identifying. Here, I'd particularly call out the weirdly ultra-wide screen resolution. That is probably quite unique amongst our pool of users. So what can we do here? We genuinely have a legitimate use case for analytics. But remember I said we were interested in what kind of devices our users were using. So maybe we could focus just on the screen resolution. And that is all that matters for our responsive design of our web app. So we could remove all of these other data fields, make sure that we are not collecting anything that is sent by default that we can't configure, and then start to aggregate. So in addition to removing unnecessary data, we can aggregate and say, OK, we have about 50% of users who are using a full HD screen resolution. We do not need to see this at the individual user level to make smart decisions about how we're going to invest in the responsiveness of our web app. All right, we fixed our analytics. The next problem that comes up is it turns out using Anthropic's APIs to send all of these chat messages and get responses is kind of expensive. So we want to add some billing. But we don't want to bill our project contributors because they are tirelessly working for us for free to test out the app. So we decide we're going to use feature flagging. And we can add a feature flag which looks at the user's email domain. And if they are registered with an email that's at our project domain, they're a project contributor, we're not going to bill them. If you haven't used feature flagging before, you can think of it as an amazingly configurable if-else statement. So the really cool thing is that we can configure this at runtime without updating the code. if you're running experiments, for example, to find out which UI layouts are best fit for your users, and you want to update those at runtime, cancel experiments with short notice without doing a new release of your app, feature flagging is really practical. And here we've decided to use it because we might change our minds later on about exactly how we decide who gets billed and who doesn't. We already have some excessive information here because actually all we care about is the domain. So we could drop this full user email that we're currently sending. Where are we sending it to? Well, that really depends because Open Feature is deliberately very configurable here. So that client could be something local. It could be a remote client that we're in control of. So at least we're not sending this data to third parties. Or it could be a third party feature flag management platform. And if it's the latter, then we want to pay extra care to the fact we're sending email addresses. Maybe in addition to just including the email domain, we could think about hard coding our project domain. If we think it's very unlikely it will ever change, then we could hard code that and actually just send the true or false here. Does it match the domain? At that point, it now starts to seem over-engineered that we're using a feature flag with this. But if you imagine we eventually have 20 different variables that we're using to evaluate whether somebody gets billed or not, this does make sense to have the runtime configurability. We've just got to keep the data flows in mind. Now, a natural follow-on from feature flagging is observability tooling, because the Open Feature docs actually recommend that as soon as you're using feature flags to start doing some targeting based on user properties, you need to have observability in place to understand whether your flags are actually working at runtime. If we think about our billing enabled flag, it would be really, really bad if we'd messed up with the logic and actually nobody has billing enabled. Everyone's using it for free and we have a huge bill that we can't pay. So I definitely want to have some observability in place to understand which value that flag is actually resolving to at runtime. Again, we need to be really careful with the data flows here. Now, hands up, who is familiar with what I mean when I talk about observability? Cool, quite a few hands. I would recommend checking out the Open Ecosystem Challenges here. If you're completely unfamiliar with observability, there's some cool space-themed challenges that my colleagues have put together. They're a really cool way to get started with cloud-native development and open-source observability tooling. Because not everyone is familiar with observability, for today, I'm just going to focus on logging and privacy in logging, because that is relevant for the most projects. Even if you're not using some big observability platform, you are probably logging something to your server. Now, here we see in this React code base, we've made a very interesting design decision. And I can hear some laughter. We've decided that every time you log something, you've got to use our privacy logging SDK, and you have to type that error or message, whatever it is you want to log, with this horrible looking type, telemetry, I verified this cannot contain user input. Now, this may or may not frustrate our developers. I think it becomes especially interesting when you assume the majority of the code in the repo is actually going to be created by agents rather than by humans. Because this is a great way to constantly remind them of this rule, to enforce policies, and the agent isn't going to get frustrated, at least not as quickly as a real-life developer if this is a big project. We do have some precedents here before you tell me this is an anti-pattern. You might be familiar with the dangerously set in a HTML prop in React that is there to remind us, hey, we're giving you this extremely dangerous capability. Please don't use it unless you know what you're doing. Because if you use it to set the inner HTML of an element, like I'm doing here, based on user input, you are just asking for a cross-site scripting attack. Now, interestingly, I have seen this pattern used in a codebase at scale. It's a codebase you might have heard of that recently accidentally became open source, which shall just be referred to as the codebase that shall not be named. In the codebase that shall not be named, a lot of the work on that codebase was done by agents, and they are actually using this pattern at scale with lots of these different types to enforce policies for agents developing code and for the developers who were reviewing the changes to constantly remind them of the rules and make it really hard to do the wrong thing quietly and sneak it through in a pull request. If we have real humans working on our project, which is still quite a desirable thing, I would say, we might want to be kind to them, alleviate some of this mental burden, and implement sanitization directly within our privacy logging SDK. Now, depending on your code base, this may or may not actually be feasible. If you have quite good standardization of the formats that your DTOs take, and you are pretty confident what kind of values you can expect in each field, then you could implement sanitization. But importantly, this shouldn't just be a few regexes that are looking for email addresses and direct identifiers, because privacy is about so much more than that. In our chat app context, for example, I might be working on a super secret coding project, and I consider my prompts deeply confidential, and I don't want you to ever be logging them. They don't contain any direct identifiers or anything that you might catch with your regexes, but they still shouldn't be logged. So again, we've got to keep context in mind, really think about the sensitivity of the data that we're processing. To take a step back a little from the code level, I've emphasized several times now that it's so important to keep your users in mind. This is really, really, really important. And if you're interested in it, I would really recommend checking out the Technical University of Munich's recently published Privacy Pattern Catalog. They've been doing a lot of research into this. And there they lay out some best practices for a huge variety of UI elements, not just these super frustrating cookie banners that we all have to deal with dozens of times a day. And what's interesting to note here is that these are not just frustrating, they're actually illegal, with good reason, because this is deceptive. Research studies have repeatedly shown that they deceive users into making bad privacy choices. If the button looks nice and shiny, I'm going to click it. And especially if it's hard to find the link up to actually make privacy-preserving choices and you add a delay and so on, you see time and time again in these research studies, really the vast majority of people clicking accept all. So these are illegal with good reason. And if you look at some of the GDPR legal cases, they are actually calling out the colors, the size of the buttons, the size of the text, the fact that this text itself is deceptive, saying, we care about your privacy, and so on. So UX really matters, even in data protection law. Now, we've been using this generative AI chat app as our motivating example, but I haven't actually talked yet about the privacy considerations of using generative AI. So most obviously, we've got these prompts. I already said they're sensitive data. And unless you're very, very rigorous with the guardrails that you introduce, you can bet that sooner or later, even though you told your users this is just for use as a coding assistant, somebody is going to use it for therapy, somebody is going to use it for legal advice, might even be the same user on the same day. So there are guardrails you can implement to try and prevent those kind of prompts if you don't want to be processing that kind of data. But in addition to that, even if you think this is a solved problem, agentic workflows introduce new and unexpected flows of data, which mean that we're repurposing data for uses that were never intended in the original context. If we imagine we've now added the ability to add MCP tools to our chat app, and here we have a user who's added a Signal MCP server. It's a custom one, because as far as I know, they don't have an official one yet, so that the agent can now search their messages. They've also added a custom MCP tool for OpenStreetMap to search for locations. And you can imagine, if you have a busy life and you really struggle to get to places on time, this could be tremendously useful if you just ask an agent, hey, what am I doing today? Who am I meeting? Where am I supposed to be? I'm half asleep. Can you tell me which tram to catch? That could actually be quite practical. But I bet that when Thomas sent you that Signal message, he never anticipated that the fact he was in hospital and his exact location was eventually going to be transferred to a third-party model provider like Anthropic. So it's really important to be mindful of these unexpected data flows that agentic workflows introduce, whether you're building products that enable users to carry out agentic workflows, or it's your own personal use of AI in your personal life. So that wraps up our whirlwind tour of privacy at the code level. I promised I was also going to get to threat modeling to help us better understand the privacy needs of our users. It's one thing to say we need to keep their context in mind, but that's really hard to imagine if you're working on a large software project that might be used all around the world. Hands up, who has heard of threat modeling already? Just to gauge knowledge. Awesome. That is really, really cool to see. And hands up, who's done some threat modeling before? Probably in a security context. Cool. Fewer hands. If you're unfamiliar with threat modeling, I think the Threat Modeling Manifesto did an amazing job of boiling it down to the core questions. It's not as complex as it sounds. At its core, it's about what are we working on? What could go wrong with that thing? What are we going to do about that? And then a little later on, because it's an iterative process, did we do a good enough job, or do we need to go back to questions 1 to 3? Now, for those of you who've already done security threat modeling, you might be familiar with STRIDE, which is a set of privacy threat categories. Lindun was deliberately designed to be the privacy equivalent of that, to make it more accessible for a wider audience to think about privacy threats. We have two that are very interesting for those who are familiar with STRIDE. Data disclosure looks like it's an identical category to information disclosure. And both security and privacy care about data breaches, for example. That's clearly a problem. But actually, this data disclosure category is a little bit broader than STRIDE's information disclosure category. This would also include, for example, securely transmitting data to a third party without letting your users know about that. So that's a privacy problem. It's not a security problem because the data was always stored securely wherever it was transmitted securely, but it is a privacy problem. And then we have non-repudiation. I usually get laughs from security people when I present this because in STRIDE, repudiation, the exact opposite, is the threat. And that leads us to the question of, okay, are we just doomed to always be in conflict between security and privacy people? Do we want opposite things? Fortunately not, because these threats tend to come up in quite different scenarios. So for example, a repudiation threat would be if I can delete all the data from the system without there being any audit log or any kind of record that it was me who did that, so you can trace that action back to me. That's a repudiation security threat. In contrast, if we're talking about a non-repudiation privacy threat, let's think about voting. If I'm trying to vote in a country that's leaning towards dictatorship, and the opposition party wants me to vote for them, but I don't feel comfortable because actually I think I'm going to get beaten up after I vote if I vote for the opposition, because I have this sneaking suspicion that the ruling party can see how I voted. That has a chilling effect on my freedom to vote, and probably I'm going to vote for the ruling party because I'm scared. That would be a non-repudiation threat. I can't plausibly deny, or at least I believe I can't plausibly deny, having voted for the opposition. Then in the other categories, unawareness and unintervenability, as the picture suggests, is really user-focused. So we need to make sure the users understand what's happening and give them control. If we don't, then we have an unawareness and unintervenability threat. Linking, we saw previously with the Google Analytics example. This is about collecting pieces of data you can link together to start to form a profile of a person. You might not know who they are yet, but you can link different web requests, different sessions to the same device and say, these all came from the same device. We don't know who owns it yet. Typically, a linking threat will lead to an identification threat because you don't need that many data points usually to uniquely identify a person. Detecting is related but slightly different. Here, this is a threat if we can identify whether somebody is part of a system and that lets us infer sensitive data. Imagine, for example, that we have a patient website, there's a dedicated clinic for treating people with diabetes, and they have a patient login section. And you can put in my email address there, and you'll get a different error message depending on whether my email is registered and you just got the password wrong, or I'm not registered at all and I don't have an account. So that lets you infer some very sensitive information about me without needing to conduct any kind of hack. And finally, we have non-compliance. This is a tricky category because it's very, very broad, depending on which legislation you're thinking about, but it could cover, for example, not meeting GDPR documentation requirements. So more of a threat to businesses and organizations rather than to individuals. Now, this still seems quite abstract. We've got these threat categories, but what do they really mean? How do I imagine how this could lead to specific harm for a specific person? There are also various different frameworks for thinking about privacy harms. I particularly like this one that was proposed by Daniel Citron and Daniel Solov in a paper in 2022. They split individual privacy harms into these categories. We've got physical harm, economic harm, reputational harm, autonomy harms, psychological harm, discrimination harms, and relationship harms. And here I've also added harm to the business because within a business or organization context, we also need to think about that. That wasn't part of the original paper. I'm just focused on individual privacy harms. And each one of these categories is also split into subcategories. For autonomy, for example, we've got coercion, manipulation, failure to inform, thwarted expectations, lack of control, and those chilling effects that I already mentioned with the elections and me not feeling free to vote. I'd also like to dig into manipulation, because this quite commonly occurs with personalized feeds. Here we have user 15978623, who is completely pseudonymous online, except we know everything about him. And we've profiled him into these rather unpleasant ad segments. We know, despite the fact he's totally pseudonymous, that he's not happy with his life, and he feels like he gets a really raw deal. Everyone seems to have a better life than him. He's really struggling with alcohol, particularly since he got divorced. He's always been into clubbing, but now he's going more and more often, and drinking more and more, and we even know exactly what he likes to drink at the club. Now, this is very, very concerning, because every time he opens a feed, every time he sees personalized ads, he is probably going to be directed in a direction that is negative for his health, negative for the people around him. And privacy ultimately means dignity. It's about the right not to be subjected to automated manipulation like this. So I hope that puts this into context of just how severe this can get. We go from a linking threat, where we just take a few characteristics about a person's device. Over time, that is used to profile all of their web activity across the web, and that gets them into these ad segments. And these really are real ad segments. I've removed the names of the data brokers, and they were part of an investigation that the markup did back in 2023. So that's how these threats can lead to harm for individuals. We also need to think about our threat actors, because probably nobody's going to come to harm if nobody is motivated to actually hurt them. There's lots of different threat actors we can think about. Just to give you an idea of a few, we have insider threat, just the same as we have in security. We could have an insider who makes an innocent mistake, but because they're an insider, they have quite extensive access to data internally. Maybe they've got the analytics data of all users, and so this mistake could lead to a lot of harm. We could, of course, also have a malicious insider who's maybe motivated by money. We could even be talking about a competitor who's after market share and is desperate enough that they're willing to invest money in buying data from data brokers, buying data about our users, and then using that to fake the fact that we had a data breach. Or maybe we're dealing with a lone hacker. And from here, we can start to imagine a more detailed storyline. Maybe he's just broken up with his partner, and he's got a grudge against them, and he is out to get them. He already knows some information about them. Now he wants to obtain some dirt on them from their social media platforms, but he's not out to target any of our other users, just this individual person. And of course, as I mentioned, your product can be the threat actor. In addition to our threat actors, what about our users? You can really continue this into a lot of detail. And if you know any UX professionals, I'd really recommend working together with them, because this is their bread and butter. They are absolutely great at putting together user personas and thinking about user needs. And so this is a great opportunity to partner with them. Two aspects that I think are interesting to explore, and this is from a project by the Open Internet Tools Project. They identified that, particularly in social media and communication settings, it's important to, as I mentioned previously, think about how technically literate your users are, but also think about the tension between their need to be private and their need to be public. If I had to put myself on this diagram, I would probably be about here. Tech is my job, so I like to think I know a bit about it, but there's definitely more to learn. And on this private versus public axis, I do a lot of conference speaking, so I actually need to have a social media presence. I want to share my talks online. I want to discuss these topics online. So I have to be, to some extent, public, but I'm also quite a private person. And so there's this constant tension of what do I share? What kind of persona do I share publicly? Another example of someone who might experience that tension. Here we have an at-risk persona, again from the Open Internet Tools Project, developing user personas for privacy and security. Shura is an LGBT rights activist in Russia. That is a pretty dangerous occupation. And to carry out his activism, it's really important that he can make his pseudonym very widely known. He needs to be able to have discussions online. He needs to be public with his pseudonym. But he wants to remain anonymous and, in most cases, keep his real-life location confidential because he could face violence or jail time if he's actually located. And again, in addition to this private versus public axis, we see that he's leaning towards the less technically savvy. So he knows quite a lot about social media, but he tends to be a bit cavalier when he's posting on social media. He might not notice that he's posting posting a message that actually is geotagged, for example, that would reveal his location. So if we are trying to design for him, we might want to make it as obvious as possible within the UI the impact of his choices, you know, really highlighting the fact that location is enabled, for example. And if this sounds cool, I would really recommend checking out that project. The slides with all the links will be shared after the Linux Targa, because they have lots of great examples here. And from there, you can build user personas that are specific to the context of the software you're developing. All right. Now, before I open it up to some discussion and questions, I would just like to suggest a few other resources you might want to check out. We already heard about the previous talks we've had here. All those recordings are available online. I maintain a Introduction to Privacy Engineering course that goes into a lot of detail about this. And also, there's some academic work on this, really pushing the limits of what we can achieve at scale in privacy engineering. Usenix Pepper is particularly great because they make all of their talks available online after the conference each year. And if you do get the chance to attend in person, it really is Chili Pepper themed, and it's amazing. There's also the International Workshop on Privacy Engineering, and that is EU-based. This year, it will be in Lisbon in July. And that's all from me. Any questions?
So thank you for Q&A. Just raise your hand, you get the microphone.
If we are talking about regulated industries, how do you balance the need for a lot of logging and documentation in regulated industries where you need to log everything with the privacy of the employees in a company? Because that's something that's often gets missed in my experience.
Yeah, that is a really tricky one. And so mostly we try to enable the customers to do that. So we are vaguely aware of sort of which sector our customers are operating in, but we don't look at their data. We don't know exactly what data they're processing. And so they know best what needs to be audit logged. And we just try to enable a lot of configurability with our product features so that they can choose what's right for them, and also try and offer a bit of guidance to them. But it's tricky because with customers all around the world, we don't manage to cover every single sector specific and national level regulation. So to some extent, the responsibility there is on the customer, and we can just raise awareness of these issues. But yeah, employee privacy is a big topic because there we actually do have some tension between security and privacy, right? And that's something that kind of needs to be negotiated between the employees and the employer to understand, yes, there is a legitimate business reason for doing this. This is really important to maintain our security or to maintain our compliance with a standard that enables us to do business, versus we are just unnecessarily tracking you and it's totally creepy. Like at some point you cross that line. Does that help?
Yeah,
it was that was another privacy it depends answer. I'm sorry. It really does depend. Yeah.
Hi, thanks so much for the talk. Super inspiring. I think I got a similar question. It's like, when you use an application or go to a website or something and have the feeling that they're like doing everything you've mentioned here wrong, like what would you as a user or a customer, what are practical ways to, like, in your case, how would you like to be approached if something with your product is wrong, or what can users do?
That is a great question. I think not every company is receptive to this kind of feedback, but you can try. I've successfully reported privacy vulnerabilities a few times, usually via security programs. So if they have a bug bounty program or something like that, then you can try and submit it there. But it is possible it will just get rejected as like out of scope. An alternative would be to try and find their privacy contact email. It's usually available in the privacy policy, and so you can get this to the attention of their legal team. But very much depends on the company and where they're located, how much they care about this. So to some extent, it might be your best option as a user is just to go elsewhere and exercise your choice there to eat away at their market share so that they actually understand this is a problem and our users really care about our privacy.
Other questions?
Yeah. Okay. So we're developing software for a product
project with users in user database, and we're kind of trying to use agentic tools to develop. I don't really care about source code leaking or something that much, or going to third parties, but I'm kind of struggling with using those tools in a privacy concerning way, like debugging or kind of reading log messages via MCP and so on. I kind of see opportunities to use that tools to be faster, to be better, but yeah, I'm kind of struggling when there's like private data in log messages, in if I want to query database with customer data, that's also kind of dangerous. I think this is still an open question, how to handle those things, but it's kind of really dangerous, I think.
Definitely, yeah. I'd say it's an open question, and it's kind of the Wild West out there at the moment. Everyone is feeling this push to innovate. We've got to be as fast as possible with AI, otherwise everyone is going to overtake us, and completely ignoring the privacy considerations. So I hope that, just like all the other hype cycles, eventually we will get to a more stable point where people no longer feel like they need to race and can actually consolidate some tooling around this, because there's lots of separate initiatives doing PII redaction, for example. I said redacting direct identifiers is not enough, but it's a great start. Redacting usernames that might appear in file paths, for example, that's a really great start. And there's so much separate tooling out there for this, and it feels like a thousand different people are moving in 1,000 different directions, and if we could just focus in one direction, we could have some great tooling that everyone could use. Yeah, so my advice there would be patience. Hopefully this situation will get a little bit more sane over the next few years.
Okay, thanks. More questions or comments or anything? Okay. If not, so let's thank again the speaker and see you next year at Linux Tage 27.